this is what our group doing the winter school, and there should be some photo here, but my phone is broken, so we just have this black and white stuff. And the topic is the orientation of grasping rulers, and I will explain what is orientation mean and what is grasping ruler mean. It's actually not so fancy as it speak like this. And in simple words, it's just give us a good definition of volume in the loop quantum gravity. And so the contents will include, it's a very basic introduction of what all these models look like and what we have done to modify to this model. And it contains, like, first I will introduce what is the Panizzuno-Rager models, and I will give the action of this model, which is very similar to the action from GR. And then, because we have the action, we can introduce the partition function, and with the partition function, as just what we do in the quantum field theory, we can introduce the generating functional. And after we have the generating functional, we can use this generating functional to grasp the observation done, and we have the source term, and then we can define all the expected value of the other observations. And what we actually calculate is we subdivide the spacetime into small tetrahedron, and this tetrahedron, and what we are focused is we calculate the volume of this tetrahedron. And
is it why tetrahedron, not other shape of the polyphonic solids? Is that the simplest?
I'm not sure. Like, I think we discussed this.
Our things have 20 faces, and you choose the one that has 4 faces. Is there a particular reason why?
I think you can choose others, but can I ask my group people why we choose the tetrahedron?
Yeah, it's the same.
And so for every tetrahedron we calculate, we have like six edges of one tetrahedron, and we can choose different edges. Like we just need 3 non-complanted. Edges to calculate the volume, and we can actually choose different edges you want. It exactly same in the classical limits. You have the you choose either 3 is okay, and so we will like check if we choose different edges, is that okay in the quantum?
What? Choosing 3 edges?
Yeah, 3 edges of the edges. Sorry, edges of the tetrahedron, and. After this, we will see the same classical limit of this calculating, and finally, we will see that because we actually in this model we have the smallest value of the length, and we, in that sense, we have the smallest volume of one tetrahedron, and this, in some sense, like atoms. And so now we go to this model, this Panizzuno-Rager models, and. The first line is the GR action we have, and we can actually subdivide this into a small tetrahedron, and this S is means one edge of the tetrahedron, and we can like define the capital S respect to every edges we have, and this capital S is respect to every edges, and we just specific it into the small tetrahedron we have, and so we introduce this too, and actually this E here is the dual space of this tetrahedron, which means dual is we choose center of every surface and we link off all the centers and we get another tetrahedron in the dual space. Space, and this E is the edge of the dual space tetrahedron, and then we can get the action of this this action is actually the model that gives this action. And we can see in the following, this action, we can see its semi-classical limit will go to the good definition of the, it will give a good classical limit of volume.
What's B large F? What's big F?
What
first line?
This E?
Whether it's big F?
This F is courage of this. Yeah, this small E is the end field, and this WIG is the SU2 connection, and we can actually write the I think it's Einstein action as this for and as look like this. Does that make sense? I think details definition you can go to some books and check, but we can like write all the steps look like this. And now we have the action, and we can just as what we do in QFT, define the partition functions, put the action into the exponents, and integrate all the stuff. And we can also introduce the source into the partition function and get the generating functional, the second line. And now we because at first we see this capital S is similar to the length. So if you have like, if you define, if you can see every tetrahedron is decided if you like decided three different edges and give them the length of the every edges, and you can define one tetrahedron. So we just say that like every observables the variable is this capital S. And so here we can write this phi is the function of capital S, and we can actually evaluate all the observables use this generating function, which is once you do a derivative of this generating function, you are grasping one capital S down, and it will give you all the value, all the expect value you want. And we can also like write I skip the detail of all of this. You can actually write all this partition function and the generating function as the sum over or multiply the 6G symbol. And this 6G symbol is like for a tetrahedron, you have like six lengths of a tetrahedron. And this 6G is, we identify every length as G plus 1 over 2. And so if you have this one 6G symbol, it means you have one tetrahedron with six different value of G. And here is in the second line is you add the source to every tetrahedron, so you get every capital G into the length of this tetrahedron. And for every grasping, which we just say like every generating part, you do the derivative to the source, and in the diagram you will see like every time you grasping, or you do every time, you do one time derivative, you will get for every each, you will get a line point out, and this line is actually G equals 1.
What does this line mean again?
It's the each of the tetrahedron.
This is one edge of the
tetrahedron. Yeah.
And when you
I think it's just come from some calculating details. It's not very important. We have a lot of rulers. It's kind of like you have the Feynman diagram rulers, and so I just escaped the detail calculate of this stuff.
And where does the dash line go?
Can you repeat?
There is this dash, the line going up, and it doesn't attach to any IJ minus sign or. So you have a shape, you have a T shape, and on two edge you have some I and a J label. And
oh, actually, it's not. It's look like this. You have, you have one tetrahedron, and you identify each a J. Its J is not the vertex. It's this line, and I think it's just this one is just some coefficient. Okay. This is the, this is not anything related to this.
So and that I is actually the imaginary number?
Yeah. And okay. And when you, every time you grasping, which means every time you do the derivative, you will get a dash here in your diagram. We'll see this, like, we'll see more specific idea of this when we do the calculation stuff. What this?
There's
not important. It's just you can like. There's no doubt. It's actually this one.
Okay.
Sorry, where does the picture come from? Like on the previous slide, you had like this generating functional. I think as well. How did the picture end up? This slide.
You mean how we come from that part to
previous.
To this part is I think I didn't go through this. It's actually you can define like because you kind of integrate over all the possible configuration you can have, and from here this multiply multiply all the tor means multiply all the tetrahedron you can have, and so at first I see you have a manifold, and then you use the tetrahedron to you subdivide this manifold into a lot of tetrahedron, and this means you like multiply you can like at first you can choose one specific you can because you can choose different ways to subdivide this manifold to the different tetrahedron, and for every tetrahedron you have a different length associated which is this GS mean, and this DGS is just the mean the dimension of the representation, and actually we have the spin we have the GS is equal to 2G plus 1, and this is this DS, and actually this three-ring simple is. You define it as some values in this. You can, and I didn't give the specific value of this 6G symbol, but you can kind of like have a abstract idea why you can come from this integral all the different configuration to this. You sum over all the different configuration, but they actually have like defined what the 6G likes, but I didn't give the details of.
So what you do is you take a manifold, you split it up in tetrahedrons, and you somehow assign a value to that, and you multiply every single tetrahedron value with each other to get the multiplication function.
Yeah.
Okay.
And yeah, so this is what it looks like. And so now we can like just as I see we can use the generating function to calculate the observables, and we can because every capital X is the length, and we can define the length square use two times derivative and plug and grasp two capital X down, and we get the definition of the errors, and use the same way we can define, we can use three times grasping, which means we direct it three times, and so we can define the volume in this sense. And so now we come to the main point is we have the different graspings. There have, because you can use different edge to define the volume. And actually we can look simply at the first one. You choose three dance that is in the same phase, and then in classically it actually doesn't define, you cannot calculate the volume of the tetrahedron use this three lengths. You can so actually the same happens for 4 and 5 and 6. It doesn't choose the for 4, you choose the same edge twice, and you choose one that is in the same phase, and it doesn't give you the volume. And for 6, 5, the same happens. So actually in the paper they include all this 1, 4, 5, 6 as the quantum correction, but I don't think we should include this. And what is really important is the grasping 2 and grasping 3, which for grasping 2, you choose that we have four vertex, and you choose one vertex, and there's three each related this vertex, and you can use this three each to calculate the volume. And in the grasping 3, you can choose like two from one face and another one that is not coplanar each, and you can also calculate the volume use this. So we are focused on the grasping 2 and grasping 3. And just make a point that what we are calculating, we actually use the dual space to calculate all this stuff. And so it's not important because I don't include the detail of calculation. And here comes the orientation, because in the paper they do not include the orientation, but it's actually important. So we just want to like include the orientation of each edges to see if we add the orientation, is there any different thing show up? Or is this same for for different grasping, like grasping 2, grasping 3? And actually, before we include orientation, you can see the volume is, for the grasping 2 and grasping 3 is the same in the quantum gravity sense. And it's good, because because in the same classical it's the same, and if in the quantum gravity it's the same, it like make this definition of volume very good. And so we'll see what happens if we add orientation. And where does this orientation comes? It comes from that the first line is just the three G simple we see before. And for the second line, there is a capital D, and every J, this D means the representation of the SU2, and the J is labeled this representation. And so we know like the representation is a matrix, so we have like matrix index below is M1, N1. And so for each EG we have here, we can define there's a G here, and there's M. M is ingoing direction, and the N is outgoing direction. This is the orientation we introduce. And so when we include orientation doing the calculation, we'll find that it's the grasping 2 and grasping 3 is still the same, and it's different from the before we have the minus to the power of minus 1 to the power of 2g5 as the global factors. But they're still the same. So it's good, like we have a good definition of volume. And it's even good because, like for grasping two, we can choose this, as shown in the diagram, we can choose the three edges. We can also change the vertex to choose another three edges, and which will give, after we calculate, will give the same, will give the same for definition as we write here. And here we can see, then we try to see the semi-classical limit of all this definition. The first line is the volume we define in the classical sense, and then because of the if you change the vector of the each edges, you will get the minus of the volume is the classical sense. And there is some unitary consideration needs this partition function to satisfy this equation. And from this two, we can have the expectation volume to satisfy these conditions. And also we can write that the partition function we defined before is the 2 multiply the real part of partition function of the GR, and use all this definition, we will get that the expected value of the volume is exactly the expected value we have in GR up to a tangent factor. Actually, even better if we use all this definition, and we will get the square of the volume is equal to the volume square in the GR. And we can also check this use what we specifically calculate here. We can see for the grasping 2 and 3, we have like three different components, and actually the middle one, the C01, is not the leading order when we compare the semi-classical limit, which means we make G very large, and then we have the C minus and C plus. This two term actually can give us the tangent factor we have before. And there's the result. We have this tangent here, and for the square, we actually do not have. It's just equal to the volume we have in JR and the classical volume. And we can just as I said before, we identify the length equal to the J plus 1/2, and this G is the representation we index, which is much the smallest is 0. So the length is the smallest length is 1/2. So we have the smallest volume of one tetrahedron, and also this G. There is another constraints for that, like every vertex, this G, 3G plus. We add this 3G, we need to get a natural number. So we can associate every length with 1/2. So this is the smallest configuration we can have in the quantum gravity. And we use before the how we define the volume operator to calculate the volume of this smallest tetrahedron, we'll get 1/6. And this is the smallest volume we can have in the space-time. So sometimes some kind of like a space-time atoms. And
Lenz assignment doesn't agree with what I know about the triangles. Triangles has like two sides that should be bigger than the third side, and according to that rule, the bottom of this tetrahedron cannot be a triangle. Like you have two sides which is one half, and you have a third side which is one.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't form a triangle.
Oh.
Right?
Yeah.
So there must be some weird.
Is the whole framework working in Euclidean space?
Can you speak louder?
Is it in Euclidean space? I mean, what's your talking about?
Yeah. I think. Yeah, we're like, because we're every small triangle is very small, so it's in the flat space.
What I mean is this is in Minkowski space or in the Euclidean
space?
The underlying space.
I think it's in Minkowski.
If you just, so the length is j plus 1/2, right? If you do this, then it's fine. Then you just have 1, 1, 3/2, and then it's a triangle.
So the thing labeled on that is the j.
Yeah.
It's actually j.
Yeah.
Okay, then it makes sense. And so we come to the conclusion. First, after we check that our other orientation, it still gives a good definition of volume. And different grasping give the same results up to a minus or plus. And it also gives the semi-classical limits kind of the same as classical. At least we can recover to the classical. And the smallest volume we got is the 1/6. And so that's all. And thanks to our group. Any question?
Why can't you just take every side be like the same length? Wouldn't that be smallest?
Yeah, actually I see before. Because when we like define the ruler of all this, for every vertex we have G1, G2, G3, and this must satisfy this. It's equal to the nature number. So if you have 1/2 there, you will get this is not nature.
Why does it have to be nature number?
I don't know. I didn't go through how they define this lures.
But the tetrahedron is the only self-dual. Because she said something about you use the dual thing to do calculation. So that's why, even if it's not the simplest list, it's still.
That's all?
wrote me a Facebook message asking if you could switch slots.
Wait, did you?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah.
Because it gives an option of it's like not necessary. And like Jing didn't agree with that one, so she probably does.
No,
there's like some local difference, which is apparently like an important thing for some people. That's a literal quote by Rick.
Oh, okay.
Alright, so next up we have Lauren to talk about gravity, entropy, and soap bubbles.
Hey, thanks for being here. We've got gravity here, we've got entropy, and we've got a soap bubble, clearly. I'm going to explain you what the connection is.
Maybe there is a philosopher's bubble.
It's a philosopher's bubble. Okay, so what's the deal with gravity and entropy? For a non-gravitational system, when you put a lot of atoms in a box and you press play, they sort of tend to spread out over all of space. And so it looks unorderly. That's what we call in high entropy state. With gravity, on the other hand, the situation seems to be the other way around. We put a lot of stars in space, we press play, and they come together to form black holes or galaxies or whatever, which actually looks more orderly than what we had in the first place. So it seems that naively entropy is decreasing, which cannot be. So what's happening? The hand-waving answer is that the entropy goes into the space-time degrees of freedom, gravitational waves or something. But we want to make this a little more precise or take some step towards making that a bit more precise. Another question that's maybe related is like a hot topic in quantum gravity, trying to describe gravity as an entropic force. Okay, so this is the story of the talk and the paper by Laurent and Yokokura, which is also the outline for this talk. We start with space-time. We choose some region of space-time with a boundary. So the boundary is three-dimensional. On this boundary, we introduce a time slicing and the time flow vector in order to be able to talk about time development. Then we try to rewrite Einstein's equation using the geometrical quantity that we obtain when we do this 2 plus 2 splitting.
What
and
2 plus 2 splitting? 2 times space?
No, it's called 2 plus 2 because you start sort of with a boundary that is 2 plus 1. It's got two spatial dimensions and one time dimension.
Then,
well, we have two directions within this sphere that we're going to be considering.
Mm-hmm.
Then we've got one spatial direction normal to the sphere, which is also normal to this boundary sigma. And we've got a fourth direction, which is tangent to the boundary sigma. So, yeah, it's 2 plus 1 plus 1 would actually be more precise, but 4 is 4, right? Okay.
The first two refers to space dimension, but the second two refers to the time dimension and some other space dimension.
Yeah, that's right.
Very convenient.
Well, that's just what it's called. Well, spoiler alert, the equations that we get in terms of these geometrical 2 plus 2 quantities, they have exactly the same form as a set of equations from non-equilibrium, well, from hydrodynamics. So the picture we get of gravity is that of a soap bubble, which is evolving in time. So then we can get a dictionary between gravity and 2D hydrodynamics, the hydrodynamics of the soap bubble. And I mean, hydrodynamics is a context where we can talk about things like entropy or entropy production. So we'll try to use this to come back to the original question about entropy and gravity and see what we can learn.
So that bubble is really a surface. It's filled with?
Well, physically, it's not filled with anything. It's not a soap bubble. It's just some surface that we choose in space-time. And we fix the surface. We prescribe its evolution. Mm-hmm. So the surface traces out this this time-like membrane, which is a three surface. Yeah, and then we look at equations which live on this two surface. Okay, so now we got to talk a bit about what we call our things. So we've got this three membrane, which will be denoted by a capital sigma. That's this guy here on the outer thing. And that is labeled by some scalar function on spacetime that we call capital R. And the membrane is where R equals zero. This membrane has a normal that we call little s. Yeah,
is this car anything related to the curvature?
Is what? The R? No, not at all.
Okay.
Sure. It's R's radius.
Why do we pick radius to be zero? Or like, is this just
a... Well, it's just some scalar function. You could have put any constant. Yeah. It's just how do you say where the surface is? You've got to prescribe it somehow. Okay, within the surface, we have then a family of two-dimensional space-like gravitational screens, which we will assume to be closed surfaces. They will be called S. They are labeled by T equals constant. So T is, that'll be our time. And every, equal surface of T denotes one of these screens. On the screens, we will have coordinates that will be called sigma. And the screen, it has a lot of normals, actually, because it's a co-dimension two hypersurface. So we will just pick one, and we will pick the one that lies within sigma. OK, then in this 2 plus 2 splitting, we have a lot of geometrical quantities. First of all, this two surface has an intrinsic geometry. So we've got an intrinsic metric. And everything you might wish for, there's a covariant derivative, there's a curvature, anything you want. And we also have a way of translating between this two surface and our four-dimensional space-time, which will be these projections that you have seen if you've attended the gravitational physics lectures and tutorials. In addition, this two surface has also extrinsic geometry. And because it's a co-dimension two surface, it has a lot more extrinsic geometry than a co-dimension one surface. So we've got the usual guy that you already met in gravitational physics, if you took it. These are the extrinsic curvatures. And this tells us how curved the surface looks when we embed it in our two-dimensional space-time. So there's two of those, one for each normal vector field. And then there's also more extrinsic geometry and also what's called the normal geometry. Basically, you take the N, you take the S, you take the Q, you take the nabla, you throw them in the box, you shake it well, and if that what comes out is not zero, you call it geometry. Okay, now we want to talk about fluid dynamics. And fluid dynamics is dynamics, so we need some notion of time development. How do we do that? Well, in GR, how could we talk about time development of some hypersurface? Well, time development is sort of derivatives, so we will want a vector field. Here we will take the vector field orthogonal to our hypersurface, and we impose the condition that, the time derivative acting on time itself is 1, which seems a reasonable normalization. Taking the time flow vector field orthogonal to the hypersurface, we still have choice because it's a co-dimension two hypersurface, so we have a lot of normal directions. And here we choose it proportional to the normal that lies within our membrane sigma, so proportional to n. Well, if we then try to write this time flow vector field using the function t and these intrinsic coordinates sigma, it takes this form. So it's not just d by dt. There's some extra term that comes from like raising indices with a metric.
What's big A, A?
Well, it's just a coefficient for these terms at this stage.
And there are two of
them. There's, yeah, the capital indices run over 1 and 2. Well, it's maybe a bit bad because here's an A, they're not the same. The upper one is an index.
They're completely different.
Yeah. Okay, then we will need something called the time lapse. The time lapse squared is just the negative norm here because we're in the signature of the time flow vector field. And it gives us a way to relate proper time and the value, like proper time along some word line and the value of this function t. Okay, up until now we've done GR. Now we'll do some fluid dynamics. And here you can admire my drawing skills. How do we figure out if a quantity in fluid dynamics actually changes in time? Consider the situation here. We've got some flow that goes through a pipe, which becomes narrower. I mean, if, for example, we just wanted to figure out the change of the density, and we look at the density here at time t, then we look at the density at the same place at time t plus dt, it seems as though the situation were static, right? Because the density hasn't changed. But clearly, the situation is not static. Things are moving. So to figure out how things actually change, what we do is a Lagrangian or convective derivative, which means we follow the flow of the fluid. So instead of writing d by dt for the time derivative, we have d by dt plus speed of the fluid times coordinate derivative. So you can also think of it as like an absolute time derivative. Okay, well before for the time vector field, we had this expression, and those look remarkably similar, right? So we will identify these vectors AA, or these coefficients, as the velocity of our two fluid. That's the first hint of the identifications we're going to make. Well, however many you like. In this case, we've got a 2D fluid. We're looking at the surface of a soap bubble, an idealized soap bubble, which just has two dimensions. But usually it would be three, of course. But
for your drawing, that's a pipe full of 2D fluid?
Well, yeah, take it as a 2D fluid. Okay, so I'm going to spare you of the derivation, and we'll skip right to the results of the analogy. Well, this looks like a long equation. It's a fluid dynamics equation and expresses fluid momentum conservation. No worries, we're going to look at it term by term. So what do we have? The first guy we saw before, the dt, that's the convective Lagrangian whatever derivative where we follow the fluid flow. Then we've got a momentum density, which we've called pi a. And yeah, we want to talk about the time change of the momentum. OK, so the momentum density, it's momentum and it's density. So if we wanted the time change of this, we've got to figure out the time change of the momentum and also the time change of the volume. Because if you just change the volume, that will also change densities. That is the reason for this second term here. We've got the compressibility sigma.
And that's different from your coordinate segment?
Yes, it is. Yeah, yeah.
We just look at remarkable.
Yeah, thanks for the remark. It's different, yeah. Okay, so the left-hand side is the time change of momentum-related quantities. And how can a momentum change? The first term we have here is the negative gradient of the pressure. A pressure gradient, as we know, that's a force. So that's going to induce a time change of momentum. Then we've got another force in our fluid, and that's the viscous stress tensor. Usually when we try to shear in non-ideal fluid, so we try to move like adjacent layers of the fluid against each other, there's going to be a force counteracting that movement. yeah, the divergence of this force is also a force term. Well, divergence of this tensor. Okay, then we'll also assume quite generally that we have some conservative form, a force, which is encoded by a potential. The potential is phi, and the force coming from that will be rho times the derivative of phi. And then we will also have a very general, not necessarily conservative external force, which is called F in this picture.
So this F is some mysterious force of unknown origin?
At this stage, it's a mysterious force of unknown origin, but.
And there is a question on this slide. Mm-hmm.
No, actually, the answer of the question comes before the question.
Oh, okay.
So the answer is the viscous stress tensor counteracts shear deformation. Okay. Now we've got the same equation, but now it's a GR equation. So what happened? What happened is that every single term in this equation has a nice GR analog, a nice geometrical analog. I'm not showing all of them. Just some of them, which are the nicest. Well, the convective derivative, that will become the projected Lie derivative along the time flow vector. So we've got the projection, Lie derivative, right. The momentum density is also some of these geometrical quantities of the 2 plus 2 surface. The compressibility also is, and actually it's the time derivative of the logarithm of the volume element of the 2 surface. Remember, Q is the 2 metric. Uh-huh.
It's obvious that this is a scalar quantity. I mean, is it the density or what is it? Because everything else in this equation, I don't know, so I'm not sure. I don't know really sure what it is.
Yeah, a scalar and what? We've got two coordinate systems, right?
It doesn't really matter. I mean, if you do some kind of Fourier transformation of anywhere you want, I mean, this thing's going to change, right? Because it's, I think it's probably some kind of tensor density or something, kind of the momentum density.
Which one are you, which one?
So the momentum density, for example, pi a, that is also transformed as a density. So it picks up the determinant of the problem or whatever.
Isn't the momentum density just the T0i component of the energy momentum?
No, it's not. No, it's a geometrical quantity. Well, I've got a slide in the very end defining what it is. But there's another subtlety, because we've got this time lapse n, which is also not really a coordinate independent quantity. And this actually enters most of these quantities. So in a GR sense, they transform not very nicely. But they cannot, because we have installed this fixed time flow. So we've got special coordinates going on. Mm-hmm. The viscous stress tensor, if it has gradients of the, well, for general fluid, the viscous stress tensor is a function of the strain, like of how quickly the thing shears. And here in this GR analogy, that's like one of the open points. The like how the stress tensor depends on the strain is not identified. So there's no nice relationship. So it's not directly related to momenta or such
so
like that.
Don't expect like, you know, a one-to-one correspondence between like the fluid dynamics of a bubble with this.
It's an analogy.
Yeah.
It's not physics, it's an analogy.
You can't like simulate like this stuff by just blowing bubbles, right?
Well, if this is a fluid, it's a weird fluid. Because we actually prescribe like how the soap bubble shrinks and expands. We'll get back to that later actually. Okay, another Q thing is the Newtonian potential, which just takes the form of a log of the time lapse. And the time lapse is actually related to the 0,0 component of the metric. So this really looks like a linear gravity Newtonian potential. The external force now is related to the 4 energy momentum tensor, which we still allow. So in this bubble picture, we can have some matter falling through and hitting the boundary, and so on. So the bubble, yes.
That bubble
That's what I mean. And the external force is going to be the A momentum density, so momentum in A direction, which is entering the screen from the outside, from the radial direction. That's our external force.
You have an analog of the Navier-Stokes equation. Do you also have an analog of the momentum of the density continuity equation?
Yes. There's actually also, we get to that. So we have momentum conservation. This is energy conservation now. This is on the fluid side now. So we already know the convective derivative. We know the compressibility. We've got the energy density here, which is what we want to have conserved. So what all will contribute? Time change of the energy, we've got some P times a volume term here. So if pressure times time change of volume, that's an energy term, right? So the sigma is a time change of volume. And then we've got the stress tensor that counteracts the shear deformation. And now we also have the strain tensor, like how quickly the fluid transforms. So we have how quickly does it transform times force counteracting it. So that's also an energy term. Then we've got a heat flux vector. And the divergence of that is also energy, which is accumulating or getting away from a point. What else do we have? Again, a Newtonian potential term. If the potential changes in time, that also influences energy. And then in the end, we allow very generally, again, we will see why, for some other energy so far unaccounted for that leaves or enters the system. OK, let's get back to the gravity side. Again, I'm only showing some of these. The energy density, for example, that's the trace of the radial extrinsic curvature. So it's the inverse curvature radius in radial direction, which means the more curved our fluid is, in the smaller the bubble is in a way, the higher the energy density. And the rate of strain tensor is the extrinsic curvature in time direction, which you can also sort of imagine. If it's curved in time direction, that means something dynamic is happening. The heat flux vector has a funny feature, namely it's proportional to the momentum density that we saw on the previous slide, which is not true for a general fluid. So that's something specific to this analogy. So now the radiative heat transfer, this unaccounted energy, that is actually the energy flow in radial direction. So energy entering the boundary from the, entering the membrane from the outside, that's going to show up in this term. Okay, now let's get back to bubbles. For bubbles, we also have a third equation about the fluid dynamics, because it's actually a two-dimensional system embedded in a three-dimensional world. So there's some radial degrees of freedom. It can shrink. It can expand. So how does it do so? Well, what are the quantities that influence the expansion? We've got the outside pressure pressing the bubble in. We've got inside pressure pressing the bubble out. We also got a third thing. We've got surface tension. And surface tension means that the surface of the bubble is trying to contract. And when it does so, then the bubble gets smaller, right? And the rate at which it gets smaller is related to the curvature of the bubble. So in the next equation, we will have another force term, which is related to the surface tension and the curvature. And the surface tension is actually, when you think about it a bit, the negative of a 2D pressure. That's not obvious, but that is so. Okay, now we also have a gravity Young-Laplace equation, which is a surprising feature of this analysis, actually. We get it when we try projecting Einstein's equations on the radial direction, So both indices, we project them on the radial direction. Schematically, we also have this, this time derivative of a radial momentum density this time. And how it changes, that's related to the outside pressure and inside pressure, and the surface tension times extrinsic curvature term. What's also there is some dissipative terms, and they involve the rate of strain tensor, they involve the momenta, and there's different things going on. So when the bubble is actually in the process of moving inside, it also loses some of the radial momentum because it goes away into other degrees of freedom. So that also shows up in this analysis. Actually, in the fluid dynamics, these dissipative terms, people are not sure what they are supposed to be. So people don't know what to write there. And funny story is, like in gravity, you actually can make a proposal what to write from gravitational reasoning. And it would be interesting to see if that's sensible in the fluid context. Okay, so far we've talked about fluids and general relativity. We have not come back yet to the original question. What does that tell us about entropy? Okay, to see what that, how that goes, we look at this relation TdS is dE plus pdV that we all know well, and we reshuffle that a bit to get it into a useful form for our analysis. First, we make these variations into time derivatives. So you can think of something varying in time. And instead of these quantities per unit mass, we write them per unit volume. So what we get is this expression. So the funny time change of the entropy density, S is now the entropy density, that's inverse temperature times funny time change of the energy plus well, again, pressure times time change of volume, pressure times compressibility. Now we use our energy conservation equation, and we can write it in this form. So the time change of the energy, the entropy density, is some divergence plus some entropy production term. And we're interested in this entropy production term. Well, the entropy production term, that's basically our dissipative terms. So dissipation means a time irreversible process. So that is going to produce entropy, and this is what we're after. So we've got stress times strain here. That's one entropy production term. And the other is heat flux times temperature gradient. That's another dissipative term. Yes, it sort of does from this equation, but it's not just dS by dt or anything like that. It's just a notation for the entropy production term. Yeah. Okay, the sad thing is in this equation for the entropy production, we still have a temperature, and we don't have any handle on this temperature in purely classical GR. Other questions?
Yeah, this asymptote. Mm-hmm. What kind of units does it have? Like entropy per volume or entropy per?
Well, S is entropy per two volumes, so entropy per area. And S dot, we can see from here, it's, well, a time change, so per time, per unit time. Mm-hmm. Yeah, basically. Pardon? Yeah. That is why. So the divergence of this entropy current is also making entropy appear at some point. But it's not actually, pardon?
But only locally.
Yeah. I think that's the idea. Okay, but to get this entropy, we actually still need the temperature. And to get the temperature, we would probably have to do a different kind of discussion. There's, for example, the Unruh temperature that you could try, but that's a quantum discussion, so that's outside the scope of this framework. Okay, so let's summarize what we have got. We've got a holographic picture of GR, so GR living on some surfaces, where the surface degrees of freedom are dynamical, and where we can have some physical intuition about how the surface degrees of freedom evolve. So it gives us the source of intuition, how we can reason about energy and gravity and maybe even entropy. And we can also think what happens like when we have a two surface and something flies through it. What happens in terms of geometry? We can take these equations and look at that. Something that sets this a bit apart from other things is that we're not referencing to simple cases such as black hole horizons, and we're not going to infinity. This is quite general. We can do this anywhere we like. We can do it right here in this room. We also saw that we have these candidates for dissipative terms, which we reasoned are candidates for entropy production in gravity. So now we have a handle on what it means and how we could argue that entropy goes from this box of atoms into space-time. But there's still a lot of loose ends. And again, I stress this is only analogy, not actually physics. So we are still in lack of a concept of temperature. So to get it, probably would need a quantum discussion. And we don't know how the stress and strain tensor are related. For a normal fluid, you have something like that the stress tensor is linear and the strain tensor or something like that. We don't have that. The relation is just general at this point. Another thing is when we have entropy production, we would like it to be actually positive to agree with normal reasonings of physics. So that would probably translate in this framework to a restriction on which screens we can place, or a restriction of how we have the shape of the screen change with time. But that's not worked out. And we've got an odd hybrid picture here, because we have general relativity on the one hand and the non-relativistic fluid dynamics on the other hand. So some funny things are bound to happen. And one funny thing that happens here, for example, is that the energy is equal to the mass density. So in order to understand that and to make it nicer, we would have to extend this analogy to relativistic hydrodynamics. And with that, I would like to thank you for your attention.
As you just mentioned, this is a very broad definition of entropy. For example, it doesn't require you to have a given horizon or anything like that. Mm-hmm. Does it extend to these cases giving the same value for GR and theories beyond GR?
I don't know about theories beyond GR, but within GR there is some discussion. Actually the quantity that arises here as the surface tension. I'll just pull it up. The pressure here. That's the radial acceleration of the screen, and in the usual black hole thermodynamics picture, the radial acceleration is actually the temperature. So the picture's a bit different. You can argue your way through it and say, yeah, in this limit that the surface becomes null, then the two normals coincide, and then these things are actually the same. So it does translate, but not immediately, just immediately. Yeah.
And I have just one other question. Mm-hmm. When you're talking about fluids, the Young-Laplace equation is a static equation, whereas mm-hmm. you have a dynamic generalization, which is really a Laplace equation.
Mm-hmm.
Do you also have something similar, or could you have something similar in this case?
Yes, what we have is actually a dynamical Laplace equation. Let me go back, sorry, yeah. We've got the time derivative here. So we're not just saying in the static case, the right hand side is zero without any dissipative terms. We're including time development also.
Okay, so it's not exactly just Young-Laplace.
Pardon?
Oh, it's not exactly just Young-Laplace.
No, it's a dynamical version.
those discrete terms like clearly gravitational wavy or?
These ones not so much. I think with the stress and strain tensor, you can argue that the strain tensor is related to the Weyl tensor, and so that's gravitationally wavy. But that's also something that I at least would like to understand better.
Also, this S dot you want to have it positive, but
yes.
You know, GR is very time symmetric.
GR is very what?
Time symmetric, in a way.
Symmetric. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, how are you going to do this? Like, how are you going to implement this asymmetry? Like,
well, I guess in an asymmetry of the condition, like condition on the evolution of the screen. Mm-hmm. It's the only thing that we can put in here, like how our screen evolves in time. So we start here, and then we have to say how it changes shape, and there's going to be restrictions on how it can change shape.
So what exactly are you doing then? Because you're already saying, like, this is the shape that my screen is going to take, and this
mm-hmm.
is going to evolve through time.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
you still have internal degrees of freedom on the boundary. You have momentum on the boundary. You have something that looks like energy on the boundary. It's just an analogy, but there's actual dynamical degrees of freedom on the boundary, and not only in radial direction, which we prescribe, but also in tangential direction and scalars. Yeah, I'll check my Facebook.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to start my presentation about tidal reconstruction method for 21st centimeter intensity mapping. First, I'm going to I'm going to introduce what is 21st centimeter intensity mapping, and then I'm going to introduce the algorithm of tidal reconstruction. At last, I'll tell you two applications of this method. First, what is 21st centimeter intensity mapping? The 21st centimeter means 21st centimeter line of neutral hydrogen. It is a line emitted because of the splitting of hyperstructure of neutral hydrogen. And because it is forbidden by principle, so intrinsic line width is very thin. So you can use that to decide the velocity of the object that emit this line. And so for higher redshift, you can decide the redshift of that object. And because this line is widely used to detect the neutral hydrogen fluctuation of the universe, for low redshift, we usually do galaxy surveys to the whole skies because for example, the very famous one is the Parkes telescope have done a high pass whole sky survey. They have found lots of dwarf galaxies and some other galaxies. But for a higher redshift, it is very difficult to distinguish a galaxy. If you want to find a galaxy of very high redshift, you have to absorb a whole sky for a very, very long time to distinguish that very faint signal of one point. And consider... From the sky. I mean, because it's very faint if it is very far, so you have to integrate for a long time to acquire reasonably good signal to noise ratio. Or otherwise, if it is too faint, you cannot see if it is fluctuation of the noise or it is the signal. Yeah, but if you operate one telescope for one night, it usually costs $1 million. So it is extremely expensive if you have to distinguish galaxy for high sky. So there's a new method for the high redshift appears, that is the intensity mapping. The basic idea is very simple. You just integrate all the signals that you receive without distinguish any of them, and you consider that as the fluctuation of the neutral hydrogen content. But that sounds very, very simple. Why we didn't do that for the low redshift? Because the noise. When you integrate all the signals, you also integrate all the noise. And for a galaxy, you have very specific characteristic like spectral or some other things, you can distinguish them from the noise. But if you integrate all these things, it's really, really hard to decide where the noise comes from and which part exactly is the noise. So the main challenge for that method is the foreground. One of the most strong foreground is the galactic emission from our own galaxy. And for that, it is 10,000 times larger than the signal of what we want to acquire. And there are also some other foregrounds, such as the noise of the telescope and the other radio source of the extra galaxies. So for this foreground, it is generally for the main brand of the foreground, we actually lose most of the signals because it is too high. But there are one way to distinguish this foreground because they are closer than the signals. So the foreground actually appears as more smooth than the signal. For example, they both fluctuate like this, then the foreground fluctuates like this when we see it, but the signal just fluctuates in this part. For those fluctuate of the signal, they usually appear as high frequency mode, but for foreground fluctuation, it is more smooth when we see them. So mainly we would describe the foreground as mainly in large in low frequency mode. So in that case, when low frequency mode, these modes corresponding to these fluctuations of the signal distance. So we actually lose the large scale information of the signals we want to observe. Do I explain it clearly? Okay. Yes, that's exactly what I want to express later. Yeah, when I'm talking about the applications, I'll explain why we really need that large scale information. Yeah, then I'm going to talk about the tidal reconstruction method. This is a method that helps us to reconstruct the large scale information from the small scale fluctuation. Because the universe would evolve as a whole, so the small scale fluctuation actually is influenced by the large scale tidal field. So when we see this shape change, we could actually deduct the large scale field from this small scale fluctuation. So the general idea is like this. First, we have an equation of motion of any particles in an expanding universe. And then we divide if we pinpoint one point, and we could divide it into the original position and the displacement. And then we divide then we can express the density contract by the Jacobi metric of this displacement. Because it is the three-dimensional displacement, so we use Jacobi metric. And then And then we also divide the displacement into two parts. One part is the influence of small scale structure itself, gravitational field of small scale. And then another part is the tidal field. Then it's very, very, very simple. We just solve it order by order, solve the equation of motion by after the divide and solve it order by order. Just I forget. I guess I didn't explain it clearly. Okay, you just divide the displacement field by the displacement caused by the small scale density contraction and the large scale density fluctuation, and also you expand the potential of the whole gravity into small field and the large field, which is denoted by Tij, the tidal field, and you solve it order by order, and you get the second line. I need.
You write it in this form. This is not exactly solved form, but this form is more clear to see. So I just write it in this form. Okay. Just you can fit this hand. Yeah. So then you will get, if you only consider the first and second order, you will get this expression for the density contract induced by the large scale structure. But here we also have the density contract induced by small scale gravitational field, but we don't know what it is. So we also do a two-point correlation calculation and transform in Fourier space and write it in power spectrum form. And this would come to this. And for this, we also have the power spectrum of small scale density field. But this one we can obtain from the theoretical calculation of standard linear evolution of the universe. So from here, this one is what we exactly get from the field we obtain. We can calculate the power spectrum of each point. And these two are get from the simulation and theoretical calculation of linear evolution of the universe. And in this form, we could solve the tidal field.
What's that? What's F?
F is the very complex form of function that we would get from previously. I didn't cite the exact form because it's very
long. So it's some combination of the other functions?
This is some combination of these and the linear growth of the universe. Yes. And then we get the tidal field, but we don't use the whole part of the tidal field because for the z direction, the redshift is not that very accurately measured. So we cannot get the high frequency mode of the z direction. So we only use the xy direction to reconstruct the field. We divided the tidal field in a symmetric way, and we only calculate the gamma 1 and gamma 2, which denotes the shape change like this, the xy shape change and the these two shape change. And from the equation we get previously, we could get the form of the xy, of the gamma 1 and gamma 2. And from the gamma 1 and the
And remember that the gamma 1 and gamma 2 are tidal field, which is the second derivative of the potential of the gravitational potential field of the large scale structure. So from the gamma 1 and gamma 2, we can actually reconstruct the large scale field, which is this. And that seems pretty easy, but consider that we don't use the V direction frequency mode. So there will be lots of noise caused by that lost information. Consider if the K1 and K2 is Kx and Ky. Yeah. If Kx and Ky, which means the orthogonal momentum, is very small, and the shear field we derive is, you can consider it as like uniformly distributed noise, then for this mode, the noise will be infinitely large, because if this approaches zero, then the noise would be very large. Yeah. So we still need a filter, and we obtain that filter from simulation. It is usually, we will do like this. If we want to do a sky survey, we would first know, evaluate the condition of that survey, and we will put that in the computer, and we calculate the noise. This is the noise, and the B is the ratio between the original signal and the new signal. And we will use that simulation to decide the range of the noise and the original signal. And we use that to refilter the field we constructed. It seems it will cause some extra problem. But this is actually only influence the scale of the noise, but don't really add some more information to individual x1, x, x2, because they are grouped by k parallel and k orthogonal. So it is an average value for all the k that have the same k parallel. So let me repeat the general procedure. When we obtain a density field delta, we first do a Gaussian smooth, which I didn't mention before. But it is very standard procedure because there are all kinds of strange things that would influence the density field. But we don't these changes are not possibly induced by the large scale structure. So we want to filter the part that are possibly from induced by the large scale structure. So we usually use the Gaussian smooth. And then after that, we apply a Wiener filter, which is select a small scale shape change. If you ignore the direction difference of the Wiener filter, the general scale change of the Wiener filter is like this. So, which means that we put very low weight to the large scale structure and put high weight to the small scale structure. And the fluctuation of the filter is due to the calculation of the fluctuation of the density field of the linear evolution of the universe. And after applying that filter, we assume that we have selected the information, selected the part of shape change that is induced by the large scale density field. So then we calculate the shear field. This is the formula that I have said before. We calculate the shear field, and we use the shear field and the Poisson equation to calculate the noisy density field. And after that, we apply a filter from the simulation, which is in order to drop the infinite noise of that part that I said previously. And then we get reconstructed. That sounds not, there are so many things that we get from the assumption and simulation. So what is the effect? This is the result that I've done to test the effect of this method. This is the previously, this is the original field that, no, oh, what I've done is that first you have an n-body simulation and you get a field, and then you use that to reconstruct that field, and you compare it with the original field that you know. I mean, because for real observation you don't know the actual field, but for simulation you know the actual field. So I use it to compare with the actual field, and it turns out that at least for the large scale part, it is reasonably good. And for the small scale part, remember the filter we use very few information for that part. So this is the information that we don't care. So just see this part, it is reasonably good.
But you have two things to compare the original one?
Oh, sorry. This is the original one. Uh-huh. This is the reconstructed one, and this is the cross power. This is the original one. This is the reconstructed one, and this is the cross power spectrum. It means that it means the correlation between the first one and reconstructed one. Yeah. And then I make the situation worse, because for real observation, first you have to reduce the foreground. So I reduce part of these modes, which actually doesn't matter much for the final result. But then you also have a high frequency cutoff, because for every telescope, it is only designed to measure a very thin brand of signals. And about that signals, there may be extra noise. So I just cut this part. And it's very serious, because this is actually the part with the highest weight. So the result is not that good. It is like this. It seems, but, We test the we want to show the cross correlation coefficient, which is the correlation power spectrum divided by square the original one and the reconstructed one. And the higher this approaches one, the better the result we reconstruct. And according to my supervisor, in real observation, as long as it is higher than 0.2, you are successfully detecting a signal. So I assume that this is successful. So now I'm talking about the application of this method and why we really need that large scale information. First is for low redshift. That is not that low. At least it should be higher than the usual galaxy surveys. It is, I assume it to be, I use the data from redshift 1. And we can use that to probe the missing baryon problem. What is missing baryon problem? It is that according to the simulation and theoretical prediction of cosmological evolution, you can get a content of baryon content. But according to the real observation, at least 30% of baryon below redshift 2 is missing. You cannot detect it anywhere. So some theoretical prediction says that it is possibly in the hot diffuse intergalactic media because it is too diffuse so that you cannot detect it. So now it is diffuse, so it is actually very, very suitable to detect that with intensity mapping because you are integrating all the weak signals from the whole space. But if you only detect it with intensity mapping, as I said before, you cannot distinguish it from the noise. So we usually cross-relate it with the KSC effect from the cosmic microwave background. And the KSC, this is a part of the SC effect. The SC effect is the hot, it is for H2, the hot ionized electron that heat the cosmic microwave background. And if it is thermal, then the microwave background energy would raise, and it would appear as small difference with the original black body emission. And for the KSD is that for the ultra-relativistic electron that heat the microwave background and change the momentum of the background, and then it would have the Doppler shift. So you can also see the shape change of the microwave background. So now we are going to cross-relate these signals, which is the hot gas I said before, diffuse gas that change the microwave background, and the neutral hydrogen we detect with 21 centimeter intensity mapping. But there's a difficulty because what we get is density field. But no problem, because all the velocity are caused by the density field. So we reconstruct the velocity. We use that relation to reconstruct the velocity field first and then correlate. Now here's the problem, why we need the tidal reconstruction. Because you see from here, it is, you see the scale is actually 1 over k. So for the k small mode, it is the main reason to cause the velocity. I mean, it is mainly the large scale structure that caused the velocity of the hot electron. So previously, the cross relation of these two signals are usually failed because the main thing that caused the velocity is missing in that survey. But now we can cross-relate them. And this is the view. Still, I'm using the simulation view. This is coming from the velocity that I do. Directly obtained from the NMADI simulation, and I calculate the KSD field. And this is the field that I reconstructed from the reconstructed 21 centimeter field. And this is the cross correlation. It appears it's actually better than the density field I reconstruct, because these parts usually mainly use the large scale density. So it is actually very successful. Then, and by cross relating them, we can see if in the future, if we use the real data, if they had that good correlation, we can actually calculate the content of the hot electron that is diffuse gas and see whether they really cause the missing baryon problem. And another application is to probe the epoch of reionization. This is actually more interesting than I'm going to test next step with simulation. It is that the the KSC is probing the ionized hot electron, while the 21st centimeter is probing the neutral hydrogen. And in current stage, these two are closely coupled. But during the epoch of reionization, they are actually reverse coupled. I mean, the epoch of reionization is when the universe goes from previously the universe is all neutral, and then the first gas appears, and the reionized small balls, and the KSC will detect that small balls. And the 21st centimeter will detect the things that detect the rest of the universe that are not ionized. So by studying the evolution of the correlation of these two signals, you can actually know the process of the reionization, how fast it is, how uniform it is, and are there any strange fluctuations. So in high redshift, we can use the tidal reconstruction to help us study the evolution of the correlation between the KSC signal and 21st centimeter signals. So that is the end of my presentation. Although it is actually a very trivial method that just help us reduce the very few parts of the help us obtain the information of the very few parts of the 21st intensity mapping. But with that, it can help us to do a lot of things that we previously cannot do, like cross-related with other signals. So I think it is very interesting. With the help of this method, you can probe lots of things. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Don Xavier.